It's Thursday, March 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Myanmar's opposition National League for Democracy nominates a close associate of Aung San Suu Kyi as its presidential candidate.
Obviously, we would have loved to have seen Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi as president, but given that, you know, the political circumstances in Burma are such that she won't be, this is an excellent second-best choice.
Canada's new prime minister arrives in Washington for a state visit at the White House, and we'll hear about Canadian singer Alicia Cara and her latest single, Wild Things. It's all ahead. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi on Thursday apologized to her supporters for not becoming the country's next president, who's likely instead to be one of her closest confidants. In her letter posted to social media shortly before Myanmar's parliament began the process of selecting the new chief executive, the Nobel laureate apologized for not fully fulfilling the people's desire. She added that she would persevere and ask for people's continued support to reach the goal peacefully. Well, 4 months after an overwhelming parliamentary electoral victory, Myanmar's National League for Democracy has nominated a close associate of Aung San Suu Kyi as its presidential candidate. Its lower house choice is Oxford University-educated Tin Jaw to replace President Thein Sein, who's scheduled to step down March 31st. From the upper house, the NLD selected lawmaker Henry Van Thieu, a member of the ethnic Chin minority. Aung San Suu Kyi is disqualified from becoming president because the Constitution bars anyone with a foreign spouse or children from holding the post. Longtime Myanmar analyst Sean Turnell of Australia's Macquarie University tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, behind the NLD leader herself, Tin Jaw represents the best next choice.
Obviously, we would have loved to have seen Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi as president, but given that, you know, the political circumstances in Burma are such that she won't be, this is an excellent second-best choice. And in fact, I think U Thin Jaw is a man of such integrity, such courage, such quiet dignity, that he'd be a good first choice almost everywhere. So I think it's a very, very good pick indeed.
Well, how did he attain this identity, this character?
He's a man with his own great story. He's a long-time associate of Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi, a long-term friend. In fact, they were at school together going back quite some time ago now, and he then went on and was educated in Europe and Oxford. He's the son of one of Burma's great poets, and U Thin Jaw himself is actually something of a poet and a literary figure within Burma. So he has great stature, even, you know, outside of politics, but as a sort of cultural figure within the country. And he also shares something with many people in Burma, and that is, you know, he was arrested at various points by the old military regime. So he's got a great story himself. He's, you know, done some extraordinary things, and for all of those reasons, I think he's a very good choice for president.
Will he be a safe choice as far as the military is concerned?
Yes, I think he will be. U Thin Jaw is one of those people who's just liked by everyone. I don't think I have ever heard a bad word against him in any context. So I really don't see any real problems on that. He's a very quietly spoken person, extraordinarily calm. And I can't imagine that the military nor anyone else will object to his candidature.
Sean, the NLD also nominated a member of the Chin ethnic group who hails from Chin State in the country's northwest.
Very interesting choice, that one. Chin State is one of the poorest of all the states in Burma. So I think that underlines that the NLD is really going to take seriously the whole issue of economic development and a great effort to lift people out of poverty. He's also a Christian, which is, I think, also illustrates, again, another commitment of the NLD's towards diversity and towards religious pluralism. So I think that too, is a very meaningful and a very good choice.
That's Sean Turnell of Australia's Macquarie University. Aung San Suu Kyi has indicated that even though she will not be president, she will rule by proxy through the next leader. Sean Turnell says while that may seem strange elsewhere in Myanmar, such an unorthodox arrangement is welcome given her almost universal popularity. The military faction of the parliament is yet to name its nominee. A vote in parliament is expected later this month, and the candidates not selected as president are expected to serve as vice president. I'm joined now by social editor Andrew Pelshevsky for a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, we have this interesting case of an Egyptian student here in the U.S. who is being or was threatened to be deported. He's actually leaving the country voluntarily after his visa was revoked because of a Facebook post where he threatened to kill Donald Trump. He said, "I wouldn't mind doing life in prison for killing this guy," after he posted a picture of Trump. Well, that didn't sit well with the State Department, who said that it was a threat against the presidential candidate. They've revoked his visa, and he's agreed now to leave the country voluntarily. But a lesson in being cautious on what you post on social media, it can always be tracked back to you, and it's often public. So even if you express these views, if they're controversial or, in this case, murderous, or saying that he wanted to commit murder anyway of Donald Trump, even if he was joking, it still went back to him and it still caused some dire consequences. So a lesson there for all our social media users out there. And then we have a case out of Canada's Windsor University. Now, I thought this was something that we could have already assumed, but I guess they've done a study on this and determined that social media use makes you more shallow, which, like I said, I think we could have determined that looking at maybe some of our friends' Facebook posts and tweets. But it's called the shallowing hypothesis. And what it is basically is that people using social media are more focused on themselves, more focused on what they call hedonistic activities, having fun, seeking pleasure, going out partying, than actual self-worth. So another caution there about using social media. It can be a really great tool for good. Posting pictures with family and friends, sharing those experiences, just make sure it doesn't overtake your life and turn you into a shallow person.
Some good advice there. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's Andrew Pelshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency's Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, or LISA Pathfinder, launched last December, recently started its science mission after completing an intensive three-month testing period. The LISA Pathfinder's job is to test and establish crucial technologies and techniques that would make it possible for a future observatory to detect and study gravitational waves in outer space. To help lay the groundwork, ESA scientists will create a near-perfect freefall with two identical gold-platinum cubes inside the spacecraft. In such a freefall, the cubes must remain perfectly still. ESA is working to create conditions that would ensure only the force of a gravitational wave could cause them to wiggle about. Over the next half year, the ESA scientists will try different ways to move the cubes and then experiment with various technologies that will help keep them in perfect freefall. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the White House prepares for a state visit by Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. As the latest round of Syrian political talks is expected to get underway next week in Geneva, the global charity Save the Children says one of the many casualties of the five-year conflict has been Syria's children. The group said this week an estimated 250,000 children live under siege, many having perished from lack of food and medical care. It says many children have died from preventable diseases and many of the malnourished have been reduced to eating animal feed and grass. Michael Clausen, Vice President for Policy and Humanitarian Response at Save the Children, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the group's report was the result of extensive and grim testimony from family members, aid workers, medics, and teachers across Syria.
They're dying. They're facing malnutrition. They're not in school. It's cold. I mean, it's a really horrendous life that they're going through.
And are we talking about the entire country or just certain pockets?
Well, I think what I would say is that to be a child in Syria today, anywhere is tough, but there's some areas which have been cordoned off from the rest of the country. They're under the UN system. They're called besieged areas, and there's about 18 of them where 500,000 people are living, and half of those are children, so 250,000 children. And besieged areas are areas where humanitarian assistance is not getting in because armed groups are blocking that. But then there's another 4 million people that are in hard-to-reach areas, which are not quite as tightly controlled as the besieged one. So life overall for children in Syria is tough. Life in those two categories is really harsh. And our report documents what essentially is a childhood under siege for these kids, and that needs to stop.
Has the cessation of hostilities improved matters at all?
I think it's started to. So we're starting, for example, to see in some of these areas, not all of them, but in some of them, convoys out of Damascus have been able to deliver things to these areas. So that's the good news. I think the challenge is, will access be sustained? That's not clear. And then secondly, what these communities need is more than just the delivery of food parcels and things like that. And when you think about, I mean, some of these stories about children who just don't have access to medical care, which means not only medicines and things like that, but also doctors, they just die because they can't get the support they need. I mean, there's a mother in Yarmouk that our report documents whose young child was very ill, and she wanted to take the child to a hospital which was outside of Yarmouk, and she couldn't get past the checkpoint, so the child died. So what's needed is a more sustained setup where it's not only things that are getting into these communities, but also these communities are able to start to provide the medical services. And then the thing that's of concern to us in particular is a lot of these children are out of school, and you think about who's going to eventually rebuild the country. I mean, what we're facing, some people have referred to the plight of children in Syria, particularly the ones in these besieged areas, as sort of a humanitarian time bomb. I think of it as sort of the potential for a lost generation. So the fighting needs to be brought to an end very soon. Humanitarian access needs to be sustained. And then these negotiations that hopefully will start fairly soon under UN auspices need to get going.
And Michael Clausen says even with a return of peace and a political transition, the conflict has set development goals in Syria back several decades. Well, the plight of Syrian refugees will be on the agenda when U.S. President Barack Obama meets Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau Thursday at the White House. Canada's young, charismatic prime minister arrived in Washington Wednesday for the state visit. The two leaders are expected to discuss ways to deepen the bilateral relationship. While Trudeau's progressive policies are much more in line with the Obama administration than those of his conservative predecessor, the two nations have charted different paths on the issue of accepting Syrian refugees. More from VOA's Jeff Swicord.
First phone call that we had.
As Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau makes his first state visit to Washington, the flow of refugees and migrants from Syria and elsewhere continues to generate headlines. Canada under Trudeau has taken a different approach than Washington by implementing a program to resettle 25,000 refugees. The reason, Trudeau says, is because it defines us as a nation. Immigration activist Kathleen Farrell, who is also a Canadian citizen, explains.
I think he was referring to a very long tradition of values of welcoming people in need around the world. So the refugee class is an important class of people who Canadians have long received. And I think he was trying to express what a lot of the general public feels.
President Obama has proposed admitting 10,000 Syrian refugees this year, a move that has met stiff political resistance. Security concerns following the San Bernardino and Paris terrorist attacks have been fueled by politicians, especially in the presidential campaign. Republican presidential candidates like Donald Trump and Senator Ted Cruz have called for restrictions on Syrian refugees.
I am leading the fight in the U.S. Senate to stop President Obama and Hillary Clinton's plan to bring to America tens of thousands of Syrian Muslim refugees. Why? Because the administration itself admits it cannot vet these refugees.
But refugee advocates like Lavinia Limon reject this argument.
Refugees are the most vetted people of anyone who's admitted to the United States.
Kathleen Farrell says there was some anti-immigrant feeling in Canada. But the story of Alan Kurdi, the three-year-old boy who was drowned last year off the Turkish coast while his family was trying to reach relatives in Canada, shocked the country.
I think that really hit people very, very hard in Canada. They felt sorrow and they felt shame.
As Prime Minister Trudeau and President Obama meet in Washington, their talks will focus on trade and climate change. But the refugee issue is likely to come up since the Obama administration has applauded Canada's policy of welcoming Syrian refugees. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Well, International Edition's Ira Melman and VOA Music's Larry London get together now to talk about the success of Canadian singer Alicia Cara.
Larry London is here, host of Border Crossings on VOA, and he is highlighting, throwing the spotlight on a young singer from north of our border here in the United States. Larry?
That's right. Alicia Cara is her name. She's from Brampton, Ontario, Canada. At the tender age of 19, she scored her very first hit last year in 2015 with the song Here, which is off of her debut album Know It All. And what teenager doesn't think they know it all? Now, Alicia has been posting videos on YouTube since she was 13, another singer-songwriter who became famous through social media. And she got signed to a contract. She performed her song Here on stage with Taylor Swift. She said that was the aha moment for her, joining Taylor Swift during the 1989 tour at Taylor's invitation in front of 50,000 people who all knew the lyrics to the song Here. Well, now she's back with her second single.
And I just want to go back for a second, because this is not the first time Taylor Swift has done something like this, right?
That's right. Taylor, on her 1989 tour, was inviting all kinds of guests, people from talk shows like Ellen to sports celebrities like Derek Jeter to many, many different singers as well. And Alicia Cara was one of the lucky ones who got invited to perform at one of Taylor's shows. And she said that's the highlight of her career so far.
If you were to pin her down to a certain kind of style, how would you describe it?
She is a pop rock kind of singer. She's gritty. She's much like a Bonnie Raitt or a Bonnie Tyler in that style and that sound. I like her lyrics. They're very real. They're very refreshing. The song Here was inspired by a party she attended with a bunch of friends, one of those parties we've all been at, which just was kind of like boring and dull, and why are we here?
That's at least the ones we want to talk
about. That's the ones we throw. But now she's got a great thing out, which is called Wild Things, which is totally opposite of a dull and boring party.
Is it the same kind of style as the first one was?
It's different, but it's still Alicia Cara. It's still, you know, a raspy, gritty style of singing that she has. And at 19, she's well on her way. She's going to have a bright career. And this album's very exciting. I've heard the album. I really like the album, Know It All.
Doesn't it surprise you, or doesn't it amaze you, I should say anyway, that somebody who's 19 years old can have the insight to come up with good lyrics?
And you know what? If you watch these reality music shows, you're finding that more and more of these tremendously talented people are young, like on the current season of American Idol. They have 4 or 5 15-year-old contestants, which is just amazing how these people, I mean, when I was 15, I didn't know what end was up. So, you know, these people are so talented, and she's receiving all kinds of nominations for awards. Show. She's up for several Juno Awards. She's up for Radio Disney Music Award and a Kids' Choice Award for Favorite New Artist. So she's hot on the scene right now. She's definitely somebody to watch.
More power to her. And Larry London, once again, as always, we thank you.
Thank you, Ira.
Rebel rouse and sing aloud. We don't care what they say, no way, no way.
That is Alicia Cara and her new single, Wild Things. And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Human rights abuses in Russia under President Vladimir Putin have deteriorated significantly in the last year, said Deputy Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Rob Bershinsky. The Russian government has stepped up efforts to suppress political opposition, suffocate civil society, silence independent voices, and stigmatize members of minority groups. The list of non-governmental organizations that have been designated as so-called foreign agents has risen to over 120, including the Committee of Soldiers' Mothers, the election monitoring group Golos, and human rights organization Memorial. The Undesirable Foreign Organizations Law, introduced last May, has already led to the banning of four significant foreign donor organizations and a decision by two foundations that were major funders of Russian civil society to cease their operations there. Pressure also continues on independent media outlets. The national blacklist of blocked websites is growing, and state propaganda is becoming more virulent. Those who attempt to speak out against these alarming trends or question government policy, especially regarding Russia's aggression in Ukraine, are subject to harassment, prosecution, and physical threats. Late last year, a court sentenced activist Ildar Dadin to 3 years in prison for participation in peaceful protest. The climate of impunity in Russia has deepened, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Bershinsky. While arrests have been made in the murder case of opposition leader Boris Nemtsov, the organizers of this crime have yet to be brought to justice. The best way to honor the memory of Mr. Nemtsov, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Bershinsky, is to support human rights, democratic principles in Russia, and international norms. The Obama administration will continue to uphold those norms. Sanctions will remain in place for Russia's aggression in eastern Ukraine until Russia fulfills its commitments under the Minsk agreements. And the sanctions imposed on Russia for its occupation of Crimea will remain in place until that occupation has ended. In addition, the United States will continue to speak out publicly against repressive laws and practices in Russia that impede the work of civil society and independent media. The United States will also continue to hold Russians accountable for their roles in the imprisonment and death of Sergei Magnitsky and other gross violations of human rights. It is in America's interest to see a strong, prosperous, and democratic Russia emerge, a Russia that can be a reliable partner in support of global peace, the type of Russian dream to which Boris Nemtsov and many other activists have devoted their lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.